this country is at war with Germany. With Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode, I'm joined by David Townsend, whose father joined the British Army in 1940 and saw active service in Egypt, then Burma and India. David has compiled his father's wartime letters home to his family and future wife into the book My Road to Mandalay. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining me. I really did enjoy your father's letters and the story they told. How did the book come about?
There were about 500 letters that I had found in my mother's loft in 2011 and really put them to one side. I'd sent them to my father's sister, and she had actually put them into chronological order. And in lockdown, at the beginning of it, I'd found another diary, and it was the journey of his trip home in 1946. And I typed this up, sent it to my brothers and some friends, and they said, oh, we want to hear more. And then I started going through the letters. And so the book is very much my father's story. I've taken the letters in chronological order and made a continuing story from the time he joined up in 1940 until he got home in 1946. And he went from North Africa to India to Burma. Again, the Burma War went on longer, and peace wasn't declared. VJ Day was quite a bit of time after VE Day, and it wasn't till June 46 that he got home. And so it's a chronological order right the way through. And what I've done to add in part, because I was trying to understand the whole story myself, so I've, at the beginning, when he gets to North Africa, explained what was happening in North Africa at that time. When he gets to Burma, I explain what was happening in the war there, the retreat of the British in 1942 and the arrival of Slim and the creation of the 14th Army. And my father was in the 14th Army from its creation in October 43, right until the end of the war. And so it's a first-hand account written at a local level, not so much about the blood and guts and the fighting, but really about what it was like to be a soldier. And the in-between bits, there was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of wartime elements, and he was a tank transport specialist, taking the tanks, the ammunitions, the Gurkhas, the food supplies to the front lines. So he was far more involved in the action than we ever thought he would be or had been. But at the same time, you've got the story of the camaraderie, the interaction with the locals, the talk about what is Burma like, what is it like to be in a situation, and his views on the people and the places. So that's it in a nutshell. And I hope that if people listen to this and then do get the book, that they enjoy it.
So let's get to your dad's story. Let's start before the war. What is your father doing in 1939? Is he 19 or 20 at that point?
In 1939, he's 90. He was born in 1920. And a little bit of the family background, to put that into perspective, his father left the family home when he was 14. He actually went off with another lady. and my father had a younger sister who was just 8. So there was just the three of them. And basically, he became the man of the house. And he was sort of like, I think, quite independent for his age. What he did, he stayed at school and matriculated, which was the A-level equivalent or whatever. And then he joined Walthamstow Council. He was basically, a clerk. That's what he was. And he was happy doing that, although he didn't like being inside. There's no doubt about it wasn't a job for him, but that's the way things work, to get a respectable job. And that was it. He was also, this was in Walthamstow. So he is an East End lad. And when he joined up, which is on his birthday, he tried to sign up before his birthday, but at that stage, they didn't take anyone into the army until they were 20 years old. So he actually went down to the recruiting office on the 13th of June, 1940. And if you remember that, that's like 2 days after the retreat of Dunkirk. You know, everyone wanted to do their bit, let's put it that way. So he signed up. he chose the Royal Army Service Corps because, you know, a clerk, he seemed, well, that's probably where I can make more use of my skills. And that
was he a grammar school boy?
He was a grammar school boy, yeah. Basically, yes, at 11, there was a faster stream and so forth. So he was quite a bright lad, there's no doubt about it. But, I mean, the other thing it was interesting to me, because I've talked a lot to his sister since, you know, I wrote the book and that sort of thing, and that, you know, he was quite a lad, because he and his mate managed to get to Calais by themselves and back again. They did various trips, but it was all, you know, boys' own stuff, if you know what I mean. But once he'd signed on, and then off he went to do his training.
When he's put into the Royal Army Service Corps, I do, because I asked this about my father, and he couldn't quite remember how much agency he had or where he went to do what when he was drafted to the Royal Army Service Corps. Did he say, well, I'd prefer to be administrative? Or, I mean, at that point of the war, I don't know how much they could sort of say where they wanted to go.
All I know, basically, if you think about it, he signed up, and everything that I know about it is taken from the letters that he either wrote home, he wrote to his sister, or later on to that lovely person who became my mother, who he didn't meet before the war. But the first letters that I have are written from Yorkshire. They are in pencil, they're undated, and they say, this is the furthest I've ever been away from home. But they tell the story that he settled in pretty quick. He sort of does a few ruses to sort of get out of the tasks that you're meant to do. And he works out how to get extra meals because he serves up for the number of plates rather than the number of people. So very early on, he's actually doing the pranks that he's probably been doing before he joined up.
He completes his basic training and he's then deployed overseas. He's heading for Egypt. Are they aware they're going for Egypt? Do they just put on ships?
No, there's no choice at all. So in a way, he went to Sowerbridge to Yorkshire. He then actually was transferred to Aldershot to do some more training. And you were saying, did he get any choice? Well, what he did there, he became a clerk duty, but he was paying the wages and he was doing this sort of thing. And what happened was that he was writing home saying, I'm going to be promoted very soon because I'm doing all these important jobs and I've got two people working for me. Totally unrealistic. And then he went to Barry Island. And from Barry Island, they literally, when they went, they were locked inside the carriages that took them to the boat. They were given basically hot weather gear, you know, they had shorts and they had, so they knew they were going somewhere hot, but they never knew where. And that was in January 41. And what he was a part of was, there were 20 large boats, biggest convoy that British, you know, had ever sent out with forces. And they ended up in the Suez Canal, in the Bitter Lakes.
They went via the Cape, though, they go via South Africa.
Yeah, they went right around Africa. So they stopped on the west coast of Africa, and then they stopped at Durban, and then they came up that way. So they went right the way around. Again, in his letters, he was saying, once we found out where we were going, we were a little concerned that we were going to become a big target, because there had been a convoy out in, I think it was December, the first one, and that had become a target, but they got there with no incident. So overall, they landed. And yeah, that was the start of him being in the 8th Army. So that was the Bitter Lakes bit.
What surprised me, though, on the way, I thought it was lovely, when they put in to port in South Africa, they're all allowed off the ship. And they're kind of like kids who've never, you know, kids, the children of the Empire who've never seen the Empire. And off they go on sort of adventures.
Absolutely. I mean, you read these letters. This is the joy of it, Angus, that this is a guy who is not thinking about going to fight battles. He's out on a world tour here. And when they get to Durban, the thing that they strikes most of them is the electric lights. I've never seen so much electricity in so many buildings and so many things. And of course, a lot of people are there, but everyone knows in South Africa where they're going and what they're going to do. And they are so hospitable. When my father and his mates, they get taken into people's homes, they get fed, they get shown around, guided tours. At this stage, they're still having a very good time.
I thought it was wonderful. You know, the hospitality shown for to strangers, and there must have been, what did you say, 20 ships. There must have been thousands of them just tipped into port. And they could just be raw because you don't know what you're getting. But actually, the friendship and hospitality showed was remarkable.
Well, I must admit, when I was doing the initial versions of this, I was sort of looking at pictures that were on, you know, YouTube, and they're on online and that sort of thing. Lots of pictures of basically the guys at that time, not necessarily off his particular ship, but, you know, being hosted. And he was saying, you know, they have these sort of carts where there's the horses or whatever. And they, but the guys were sort of pulling along. They were having fun as well as doing anything else. And it was, quite an event. But then they get to Suez and reality starts to strike a little bit.
He'll have arrived sort of, so if he shipped out in January 41, we're just starting all those North African, those desert battles where it's all toing and froing. So what's North Africa like for him?
Well, so what happened when he started, I mean, as he put it, he was in the sand. So at this stage, the Germans were putting in mines into the Suez Canal every night, and the guys that were in the sand, their duty was to either get them out or do whatever was needed. But at that stage, he got a posting, and his posting was to go to Benghazi. And he starts off on this trip. And then by the time he gets to Alexandria, he's told to come back again. And what had happened, this is the interesting thing, that if you think overall, it was the Italians who were the big, you know, they were the main fighting force initially in the war for on behalf of the Germans, because they've been fighting there since 1937 with Eritrea and, you know, other parts of that. So they had, they were looking as though they were winning. And then I think it was Wavell that was in charge of them. He said, look, if we retreat into Egypt, let's hope that they overextend their lines, which they did. And just at that time, this is literally as my father and that was arriving, they got 138,000 Italian prisoners. And at the same time, Mussolini had asked for help from from Hitler. He said, well, I've got this guy, he's pretty good, but, you know, he's not a senior officer, but he's okay. His name's Rommel. I'll send him along with a few panzer tanks. And his orders were just to go to Tripoli and protect Tripoli. So what had happened, this is all at the time my father arrived, Churchill thought, we're doing great, you know, we're doing great there. And the Greeks have asked for help. So please, Mr. Wavell, send 58,000 troops to help the Greeks. And Rommel arrives and he thinks, I've got a chance here. I won't stay in Tripoli. I'll come right along. And he was heading evidently towards Tobruk. And he got to Benghazi, which he got to Benghazi as my father was told to turn round in Alexandria and come back again.
He got to Benghazi before your father did.
So my father got back. And by the time he got back, most of the people that he'd come across on that boat with, they'd gone off to Greece. You know, he literally had missed the drafting. And so he waited there another few weeks and he got a posting, which was a delightful, really, to the HQ, to Middle East in Cairo, as part of supplies and transport, which was, amongst other things, the vehicle element of that is what he got involved in. And he was there for a year, basically supplying or doing the logistics for supplying the tanks, transport and everything else to the front line of the Eighth Army.
It's funny because, oddly, I'm sure everybody else has just watched Rogue Heroes, which has a portrayal of Cairo as actually being sort of jaunty clubs and bars and still sort of swinging. How did your father find Cairo at war?
Quite good. I mean, this is the thing. They did go out, in this unit that he was in. I mean, he always, you know, he said, you know, there's three of us. I call him the general, but he's really the sergeant. And then there's the corporal who is the, you know, we call him the major. And then there's us two as happy privates. And we go out in the bars, we do other things in the evenings. They worked hard. They worked from, say, 7 o'clock in the morning till about 9:30 or something. It were long days. but in the evenings they would go out. And he also managed to get some leave while he was there, and they went to the pyramids and they went to Luxor and they did some cycling. And by the time they got to Christmas, I think it was nice because the members of the Eighth Army, they left a tank transporter and a German tank in front of their offices, and it said, "Thanks for doing such a good job, boys." So they're evidently doing something worthwhile, but it wasn't all fighting, you know, it wasn't all fighting, and they weren't near the front line. They did get bombed, they did, and there were problems here and there, but overall, it was a lot of time in an administration role for that side, that side.
Yeah, as you said before, it's not a part of the war that you think about, but someone's got to make sure everything needs to be where it needs to be. What surprised me, I was quite tickled by the fact that they could go on jaunts to the pyramids in Luxor, which, I don't know, you wouldn't have thought you'd be able to get like to Luxor from Cairo easily on a tourist ticket or hitch a ride.
Well, the other nice thing is he bought himself a camera. So I've about 300 or 400 pictures, all that he sent to his sister, all with the sort of itemized things of this is that and the other. You know, I've got the whole thing. I couldn't put them in the book, but I've got loads of other memorabilia that, you know, was evidently, you know.
I think you need a follow-up book.
Well,
I was going to say, especially if he's bothered to write on what's where, so you know.
I have detailed letters of, you know, 20 or 30 pictures at a time, you know, so it could be.
My father never bothered to write anything on his pictures until, you know, not long before he died. And I sat him down and made him write on the back. And half of them, he wasn't completely sure where they were and couldn't remember all the names. It was like, if you'd only done it at the time, it would have been, you know, it's because you see your pictures often, don't you? You wonder who these people are and people can't remember. It's wonderful that you know who, what,
yes,
and where they are.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if he's in Egypt in the British Eighth Army, how does he get himself into the Indian Army?
Okay, so if you think about it, he's there for a year. He's evidently thinking, in part, I need to do a bit more than I'm doing now, I think. I think he's also thinking, if I go home, in some of the letters he talks about, well, I'll see you next year, I'll see you soon or whatever. But he did actually apply for 3 other jobs before he was offered this posting in the Indian Army. So initially, if you remember Wingate and the Chindits, and they were doing that, so he applied for that. And I've got a letter about him applying to become part of that, but he didn't get accepted. I've got one, a letter that he was applying for doing sort of the code crack breaking things, you know. And then he wrote, and he was saying in his letters home, he said, every time I apply for something, it gets turned down and they tell me I'm better off staying. I'm more important doing what I'm doing than doing anything else. So when it came to he saw something in the magazine, there are, you know, military newspapers and that, and he saw that the Indians were recruiting British officers because, if you think about it, the retreat in Burma had been in 42 and we'd had, I don't know, 13,000 British and Indian officers and soldiers lost in that retreat, which is the biggest retreat of the Indian Army. So he saw this and he said in his letters, so I've applied for this, but I haven't put it through normal channels and I'm going to wait and see what happens. And then 2 guys, they were both colonels, came along and they were doing interviews at his base, and he got an interview. And basically, they took 25 people, and he was the youngest. He was 21 at that time. He was the youngest to be accepted into the draft. So that was, we're talking March 42. So he's had it shipped out, done his time in S&T, and then he's shipped out from there, and he goes to India.
And this is for officer training?
Yes. So what happens, he gets to Bombay, and then he gets a train up to a place called Dehradun, which is a little bit north of Delhi. It's on the slopes of the lower parts of the Himalayas, basically, in the north part. And that's the Indian version of Sandhurst. Okay, so he gets there. It's another world, Angus. I mean, the bits that stick in my mind, he says, right, I'm promoted. I'm now on sergeant's pay, and I get this much until I qualify as an officer, which I think was £108 a year or something. And they don't get any money, they just get credits, okay? And he said, but they've given me £35 to attire myself as an officer. I mean, and in those terms, that's a lot of money. So he had to get himself kitted out in the uniforms and everything and whatever. And he's at Bearer Dun doing his officer training for, I think it's about 4 months. And they pass out as a team. But then he goes on to do specialist training. And he goes specialist training into supplies. And he writes home and he said, you know, I'm doing supplies, but this includes looking at how cattle teeth are and, you know, looking at the oxen and doing the supplies of the food and everything like that. And so he becomes, and this is evidently, you know, supplies training. And then he does another piece, which is what's going to be his future, which was the military transport training. And he goes to Kakul, which is further up. You were talking earlier on about Pakistan and India. Well, at this stage, Kakul is in Pakistan now, but it was part of India then. And it's nearer to Kabul, really, than it is to Bombay. And he was right up there, and they did their training. And it was quite serious training because, you know, he writes home, I thought I was a good driver until one of my mates drove his vehicle over the edge and everybody was killed. I mean, they were training on Himalayan roads with tank transporters and jeeps and so quite serious training.
I know it's funny because when I read all that, I'm just thinking of, you know, the smaller sort of vehicles. And then I had to keep reminding myself, he's talking about articulated tank transporters and things. You know, these are not small vehicles traveling on roads that are not built to take such vehicles.
And then you think about it, this was a stage when these sort of vehicles were new to, you know, to them. So icy roads and the rest of it. But again, he does all that and he seems to, he always makes light of it, comparing the person that I'm writing in the book about. He's not necessarily the man that I knew as my father. My father was much more, this is a young man who evidently matured later on. It's quite an interesting setup for me, but it was intense training.
I presume he's expecting to be leading Indian troops who are going to be driving all these vehicles.
Yeah. So as part of this training, he was in the Indian Army. He had been asked and he learned to speak Urdu fluently. And then his training is completed. He becomes a lieutenant, second lieutenant. And then he's transferred to a British transport company, number 589, and goes and meets the other people there. But his job is one, he is in charge of all of the Indian troops within the division. So any of the drivers, anyone that is not English is his responsibility. He's also in charge of finding out for the convoy where they're going to stop each night, where the water supplies are going to come from, and, you know, and their supplies, their food.
The logistics of operating a convoy.
Exactly. And so he goes down and meets this place in a place called Dond, which is, as he put it, it's in as far from the middle of nowhere as... And he said the only, and he, this was about another, he went down to Bombay and then back up again to Don. And he said, you know, the only reason it's there is because there happened to be a faint sort of blemish where a river should have been, and there were a few trees. Apart from that, it had nothing to signify itself. This was the nice thing. He met up with this transport company, and the guy who was second in command, a guy called Sid Hawes, was a guy that he'd done his training with in Kakul. You know, he was very nervous about meeting this guy, but at the same time, once he had and met them up, and he felt very much at home, and he was with Sid Hawes right until, well, after the Battle of Imphal anyway. So he got transferred later on.
We're going to take a short break. I'll be back with you in a moment.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome back. I'm talking to David Townsend about his father's experiences during World War II. Do you know what how he got on, or how he felt about working with the Indians? Because it must be very odd, a guy from Walthamstow sent to India, have what must have been a very short course of speaking Urdu.
He started learning Urdu on the boat. It's one of the first things they did. On the boat from Cairo to India, they started learning Urdu. During the training, they had evidently been doing exercises on vehicle transport and everything, and a big part of that was carrying on learning. So he'd had a year to learn it, basically. But when you read the letters, I think what we have to understand, the world now, Angus, is very politically correct, okay? And I do point this out in the book that, you know, he's sort of saying that these guys are coming to join the platoon and that sort of thing and be trained. And he calls them junglies. He said they're straight out the tree, which is terribly to say, and it's not right at all. And we know that, but it was a different time. And the other thing he did do, I thought was admirable, he made sure he knew everybody's name. He said, one thing I want to do is, if I'm in charge of them, they know who I am, I need to know who they are. And he did learn everybody's name. And he also, as things went on, was celebrating their customs with them. So sort of the festivals and that sort of thing. And he would get involved and they would have the mess dinners and that sort of thing at the times when they wanted to celebrate, not just Christmas, New Year and that sort of thing.
Well, I think the point he sort of also makes is he's got these guys who's been sent to him. You know, they're from a very different background and they're giving technical roles that they don't quite understand the roles themselves. They can't necessarily read. They're from a completely different world that is not familiar with trucks and lorries. And they've been given him to sort of whip into shape into drivers and things. So it must have been an enormous culture shock for everybody involved.
But absolutely everybody. The unit that he was assigned to in Dond, and I can show you, I have the papers for this trip that they did. It was a top secret mission at that time. I've got the names of everybody that was on board, all the Indians as well as the thing, and the secret orders. And their job was to get 200 vehicles from Dond wiggling round over the whole of India to end up on the East Bank where they're going to be needed to get to the battles later on. And so you've got this, and it took 4 months, I think, to go up and down, up and down. With all his stories about these people that we're going through, they've never seen these vehicles before. They don't understand what it – and they – there's part where he said, we've made history, because they took these vehicles across a bridge, which was a very long bridge. But after that, it was basically outlawed. No one will ever do that again.
It's funny because whoever designed that – when you see the track, you say wiggly is the way it works. I mean, they must have just – been going on roads that they could go on, but if you were going from here to there, it was not at all a straight line.
No. And basically, I think they did about 18. He said it was 1,800 miles for the convoy, and about 2,200 for him because he was going up and down and checking things out and coming back again. So that was an incredible adventure. Incredible.
But the miles. I'd be reflecting on the miles that it did, because my father said, so, you know, after so many miles, the vehicles were just done and they were scrapped. And you think, well, your dad, you know, if he's done 2,000 miles just on that, I wonder what the state of the vehicle is by the end of it. You know, the amount of maintenance that must have gone on for days to keep everything running in what's a relatively hostile environments with dust and poor roads and everything else must have been astronomical just to keep the whole thing moving.
I was saying earlier on that he never talked about this, but I do remember he did have this theory about, you know, if you get in the traffic jam, the law of convoys, that it's 5 miles an hour at the front and 60 miles an hour at the back. But the average speed overall was about 11 miles an hour if you were lucky, you know. And then he would also write back. He said, I can't understand these guys on these transporters. They've got, I've forgotten how many it is, but it's about 26 wheels, isn't it? He said, and he said, they get a puncture in one of them. They've still got 25, and I can't understand it. They want to stop and mend that one. I just love the fact that whatever the circumstances, the sense of humour comes through, you know. It makes it very real.
Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of, I've made a note of optimism almost. He's not down. He's not hand-wringing the woes of it all. He's treating it all as a young lad on an adventure, seeing the world, which is just, you know, remarkable, which, you know, it's completely alien, which is a word, again, in my notes I kept making, you know, how does he make of the alien environment he dropped into? So they end up at that Burma border, and I don't quite recall the date of what's going on as he arrives at the...
Yes, so they get to a place beginning with R that has escaped me for the moment, which I'll think of in a minute. And they are based there for 4 months doing supplies, getting basically everything in place for what is going to come, which is, you know, getting the military positions into, it's basically into Manipur, which is in the northwest corner. So he's there for 4 months. So that's basically getting things sorted. And then he gets a note, transfer to Imphal. Okay. Now, as he put it, I just found this on my map, and it's on the very northeast corner of my map, and I've never really heard it before, but it's the Manipur, the 6 states in the northeast corner of India, and this is one of them. And so his orders are to get transferred, and he said, what has happened, which is good, I'm not going to be on the convoy. They've said that, you know, I've been doing all this stuff, I've got permission to take the train, and I'll meet the convoy in Imphal. Well, what actually happens is that the convoy left, they actually get stuck on a bridge. He gets the train with 2 other officers, and I think there's about 10 of them who get the train, and they overtake everybody. And this trip, I mean, if you think, it's about 1,000 miles, okay? So, number one, he says, well, we're on the train, but I had a word to the engine driver, and I managed to get onto the footplate for a good time of it, and we were stoking the engine. So this is still a young man of 22. You know, I'm enjoying myself. I'm having the biggest train ride of my life. And they get to the end of the train journey there, and they get transferred to first vehicles and then boat, and they come down. And actually, the other way around, they get the boat and then the vehicles, and they come down what is the Manipur Road, which if you get online and you see the wiggliest, windiest road that you've ever seen, well, that's it. And they're still riding in backs of trucks at this stage. What happened overall is that he arrives in Imphal ahead of the convoy, ahead of certainly the schedule that the colonel that he was to report to had in mind, and he arrives in Imphal at night, and is the colonel says, well, who are you? He says, well, I'm Lieutenant Townsend. And he said, well, you're not meant to be here yet. The guy says, well, as you're here, this is where we're going to camp. You've got to set up this, that, and the other, and your orders are to do that. And then my father went into one particular hut where there's a lot of people, including mothers and babies and that. And he came out again. He said to the colonel, you do realize that there are people here, don't you? And the colonel said, yes, part of your job is to evacuate the village so we can set up camp. So yet again, big induction. There's a lovely bit in the letter where he said, I went back into this place and I just said, does anyone... You know, he said in Urdu, that's right, you know, does anyone speak Urdu? And there's nothing. And then he said in English, I don't know what I'm going to do now. And someone turned around and said, we'll help you, don't worry, in perfect English. He said, we knew that we were going to have to leave. Is it okay if we leave by the day after tomorrow? They agreed it. And that was the start of the induction into Imphal, which again, he puts, he's a very good writer. He's, the whole book is his book, not my book. I'm really the person that is making it more widely known, simply because I think people should know about the Burma War and the way it was fought. But
well, they are cracking letters. They're really good letters. And I'm not completely sure how much, up to a point, he's keeping out. I think you get quite a lot of his war, because his war is not necessarily a war that's going to be heavily censored, provided he doesn't say where he is.
Well, that's right. The benefit of this particular tale that I'm telling you, and it's worth maybe for your listeners to understand that when my father joined up, he's rather sweet on the local librarian, and she'd been writing to him for a very long time. But he got a letter in December 43, just as he arrived in Imphal, from his mother to say, very bad news, but she's got tired of waiting for you and she's married the chief librarian. He'd basically been dumped, you see. It's terrible. So he then asks for his mother if anyone would write and become a pen friend. And his mother asks at a canteen where she's a volunteer worker. And evidently my grandmother says, my daughter's 20 years old. She writes to troops. She'll do that. And they started writing together in January 44. Again, I'm jumping ahead here, Angus, but forgive me that he did end up in a field hospital and he had some time. And he wrote a booklet, which is about 35 pages, what I've got here. And everything that he says in this wasn't censored because it had already happened. So he could tell the story basically as it did happen and it was now to be released. So this is the sort of thing that he could do.
But even then you get the feeling that this is his war as he's reporting it, and it's not, he's not talking about great swaths of movement from here and there. It's a very personal hit. And to be fair, it's often occurred, you know, I think there's a boom at the end of the war in books about the war because men didn't know about the war because they weren't told about the war. They were just told to go here and there and they didn't really know what the big picture was.
Yeah.
I think that's very much what you get. I have to go here and we have to shift this and we move that and that and the other happened.
You just reminded me of there's another lovely bit where again later on, of course, they get to see films. He does write back and he said, I've been told that I'm now off to see something that's going to tell me the story of the Burma War. I'll see what really happened, you know.
Is that Victory in Mandalay?
Yeah.
Is that what the film's got? Really amused me that he's watching a film about him at the time. It's made all the time. It makes you wonder how they all reflected on watching that when you sat in the cinema with them all, seeing how they're being portrayed. So when Imphal and Kohima, the fighting in Imphal and Kohima, is he still a lieutenant there, or does he have his promotion? I can't quite remember the chronology.
Well, okay. To put you in the picture, once you've done all this wonderful training with the Indian Army and they've spent all the money on you and it's taken all this time, they say, right, you're a lieutenant. There's not a lot of you. You cannot be promoted until peace is declared.
But isn't he applying for captain's promotions anyway?
No, he is not made a captain until peace is declared and he gets into the peacekeeping force. And then soon after that, he's made a major. But for the whole period, he's not allowed to be promoted. He thinks about going to apply for other jobs because of this very fact. But all the way, he says, well, actually, I like what I do. I think it's important. I'll carry on. And your point about, well, he was telling his personal war, not the wider story. I think once the Battle of Imphal starts, he and his company, they do get involved so much in the action that is really the proper battle in a way, because what they're doing at that time, just put again this in perspective, this is February 42, there's the Battle of Arakan, which is, you know, very important, and Imphal starts in March 44, and 589's job was to get the tanks up the road, as it were, to fight the Japanese, and all of that time they were being bombed, they were being shelled, they were being, you know, in action. And they would get up and put the tanks in place, get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, get them in the right place, And then they would go back and collect them in the morning. And there were periods, there's a period when he said, well, I've had 2 hours sleep in 66 hours because you've been doing this, you've been putting out. And then when he's on duty or whatever, he's flipping writing letters. But they are very much in the action. And basically, again, there's no feeling of fear, but there is frustration of the vehicles maybe breaking down. There's frustration of, but he then talks about how does it work? What is the routine? And everyone is a team. There's no doubt about that. So it's interesting.
One of the comments that's surrounded on three sides, and I thought it was an interesting comment because there is this whole thing about the boxes and don't panic if you get surrounded because we'll get you worse. We can supply you by air. And there is no sense of panic. There is, well, we passed this, that, and the other, and 2 hours later that was attacked because from behind. But he seems always quite confident, and there's no sense of panic or fear. That's not to say he's not feeling it at that moment in time. But I just thought it was a testament in the belief that everyone keeps saying, oh, Slim told them, if you're surrounded, don't worry, don't run, we'll hang on, we'll get there.
Well, it was even more than that, Angus, because when Slim came in, he said, the mistake that we've been making in the past is that we have been retreating. What I want you to do is to dig in, and he developed these things called the boxes, which were, everyone had their 7x5x5 own pit to go into. And he'd increased the air support hugely so that once they got under fire, once they had the problems, they were told, you stay where you are, we'll look after you. Looking at that piece about where the Japs are 3 miles away, I've got a quote here, because he said, imagine, here's us with Japs 3 miles away in one direction, being soothed to sleep each night by the comforting sound of our guns, and some twerp manages to find a form which asks, do you reside abroad for the sake of your health? And do you claim to be a British subject? If so, on what grounds? So he's just got his income tax form. He's in a hole. And they said, look, what are you doing there? Are you really on our side? I mean, this is where it's incredible that he's, even in that situation, his humour stands in. And another quote here. We're going to have to leave it to the historians to find out that it was our company which stopped the invasion. No transporters, no tanks. No tanks would have meant different results in several battles. Yeah, so they were very much involved in the action. The camaraderie between him and Sid Hawes and Robbie Robinson's another man in the thing, they looked after each other. You got to think, this battle went on for 4 months and there were 60,000, most of them, I have to say, a lot of them Japanese, did die at that time. And it wasn't publicized. Basically, when it was success in July 44, they declared victory. And this was, of course, 2 weeks after D-Day. And everyone wanted to know about what was happening in Europe and America and so forth. And again, another big reason why this should be far better known than it is.
You mentioned air supply, air superiority. Your father gets leave and he actually, he flies out on his leave.
Yes.
Which is amazing that they could find space for someone going on leave for transport.
Well, that happened literally. It was July 44. Basically, his commanding officer said, look, there is basically a space for an officer to go to have 2 weeks leave. And it's meant to be someone that is war weary. Now, you don't look war weary, but we do look at your last day's leave was 18 months ago. So they sent him. That was the first time he'd flown in an aeroplane. There's a detailed account of saying, have you ever flown? He's writing my mother as a pen friend. Have you ever flown in an aircraft? It's fantastic. Looking down on the hills and the islands. The guy who is an American pilot who took them, he basically saying, yeah, we are going, but be aware that it might not be as safe as you want. But he did go, and 2 weeks. Living it up, living in a hotel, really reconditioning himself. And by the time he got back, he was really, because this was the end of the battle, their job then was clearing up the battlefield. And they had to go and collect all the Japanese tanks and get everything back. Because he goes and collects the tanks, and basically didn't want our troops, the British, Indians, and the people, the Allies, to think that the tanks were theirs. And so what he does, he makes a Japanese flag out of an old pair of blue pajamas. He's got puts a big red circle on it and puts some hieroglyphics on it, puts it to the front of the convoy. And so it looks, it was very clear that it was Japanese tanks that he was collecting, you know. But that carries on a while as well.
And it's a really smart thought, you know, to demoralise people to think that you're withdrawing battered allied equipment. You're actually just policing Japanese wreckage. Where was he when VE Day was announced? Well, was it a thing for them?
So by then, there's quite a lot happened because the Battle of Imphal was July 44, and then we've got another year yet, by which time he has been moved away from 589 Company, been seconded to the Dagger Division, that was Major General Reese, wasn't it? And basically that whole area had been, at the beginning of 45, the retake of Mandalay. And so my father had gone right the way through with 19th Division. Somehow, he was the second service personnel into Mandalay. And I'm thinking, you know, the 14th Army, there's 500,000 soldiers in that, and there's heaven knows how many vehicles, and he happens to be in the front flipping jeep. So what happened thereafter was that Mandalay was taken. He is actually then taking out the prisoners of war, which were the Indian and the residents and so forth, from the Japanese prison camps. And then he is asked to assist in with the move then to Rangoon. And by the time VE Day happens in Europe, they're still fighting. And basically what he's saying, there's a lovely letter that says, someone tell our Japs the war is over, because you've got Hiroshima, you've got the bombs have fallen, but no one told the Japanese on the ground.
When you get VE Day in Europe, there's obviously May, June, July, there's months of fighting still to go. I wasn't sure how much you get reported, because I asked my father what happened on VE Day, and my father couldn't remember VE Day. He just said, for us, supplies needed to be moved. So it was not as if we could all have a day off, because we had a day off, supplies didn't get somewhere. And I suddenly thought, I wonder what happens in Burma, where the supplies have still got to get there. This is no celebration. Yeah. And the war's still on.
VE Day was recognised in a letter by him to say, you know, I hope you had a good celebration, but there, nothing actually had changed. I mean, the bit that changed initially was that when, at the end of the Battle of Imphal, the road to Kohima from Imphal had been opened. And so from my father's perspective, the other half of the convoy, Robbie Robinson, and those who had been fighting and transporting at that end came, and their food and their drink and everything improved no end, because the Americans had assisted and so forth at that end, and so they had better supplies. But again, he said, someone tell our Japs it's over. I've got another quote here. He said, 10,000 ruddy Japs want to go home across our road and have started to do so, blocking the roads in the process. Then up comes a backroom boy with a letter addressed to me saying, you will proceed to XXX with ammo at once, the place being on the other side of the Japs. So he had to carry on, and it carried on until... Really, there was a celebration when the Supremo, Mountbatten, again, my father was involved in that and setting up the stage and that sort of thing. But after that, peace was declared. And that is when my father started writing letters to say, I've been a chairman of the sub-lieutenant's board for so long, I need to do something else. And he did then get promoted. So it was... in August, September, October, 45.
Slightly slipping back on the chronology game. So what did he think about Burma? I mean, how does it compare to India, as he's moving these convoys at 5-10 miles an hour for miles and miles and miles?
Parts he loved it, parts he hated it. There's no doubt. And he writes a lovely, lovely letter saying, If anyone wants to know what Burma is like, this is it. You all think it's jungles, and that is the way we came in. It is jungles up the top, and basically once you get into the area coming south to Mandalay and Perth, it's a lot of nothing. You get pagodas everywhere, you get space, you get open, and it's really not the jungles that everyone expects. And he does write very lucidly about not only the people he meets, the places, and the interactions he has with them. And there's no doubt, you know, early on, he, at Imphal, he's sort of befriended by the Naga people. And when my father was there with them, he said that they're sitting on the door of my hut, except there's no door. And then they made him a charpoy, which is a very comfortable bed made out of bamboo. They also gave him a Naga puppy, which is basically a very big hunting dog, really, more like a Dulux dog than anything else. But the dog Slash was with him for the first 2.5 years riding along. And when he was out on convoy, he'd leave it back there. And he went back another time and he said, oh, Slash has had another 8 puppies, you know. He got a lot of experience out of Burma. There's no doubt about it. I think the reason he never talked about it to the family or anyone that he came home, I think parts where he went into Mandalay and his job was to take the prisoners of war out of the prison camps, and that, I think there were some very, very nasty parts that are best just blanked and forgotten about. But overall, the letters come across as though it was a good adventure.
Well, I was going to say, he is dealing with Japanese prisoners of war after the end of hostilities. How did he find them?
His job was to take, it was a Japanese prison camp where basically the people that had been living in Mandalay and later on in Rangoon as well had been living for 2 years. They were the people that probably were the bad side of things because they didn't look after their prisoners. After he's part of the peacekeeping force, when after his peace is declared and he's promoted to captain and then later to major, and still only 25, but part of his role was a prison camp built for the Japanese. Now, the interesting thing that he's saying there was that up until maybe the last 3 months or whatever, they'd had 40 or 50 Japanese prisoners, most of whom either had dysentery or they weren't able, quite honestly, to kill themselves. Basically, the indoctrination was such that they should not be taken prisoners. And so up until then, there'd been very, very few. When peace was declared and so they were clearing up, they actually got the Japanese, one, to build a prison camp, two, and he writes home, the Japanese are doing most of the jobs within the prison camp. He had to go there to inspect and take colonels to look around, but it was the Japanese that were very well behaved, looking after, they were well fed. And again, it's an insight as to how we treated our prisoners as opposed to the Japanese treated theirs.
Yeah, well, I couldn't work out, it was slightly mixed emotions he felt about them, because he somehow almost seems impressed with their demeanour, if that makes sense, but not necessarily wanting to like them.
I think there's a respect. I think respect is probably an understanding that they are soldiers and they've been doing what they've been told and instructed to do. I never get the impression in any of the letters that there's any animosity between him and the enemy, as it were. But at the same time, once peace is declared and they're interacting, there were a lot of jobs to be done and there was not a lot of people to do it. So you had to find, they were the ones, you know, most of the British troops and Indian troops had left. He was part of a small force that was there. He'd been transferred to, it was the Forward Airfields something organization, and their job was to look after any airfields which were in the forward lines of battle. And there is a part where a letter is received wanting to transfer him to Cambodia because all right, because there was still something going on there, and his senior officer says, no, I think you've done enough, you're staying with me.
But by 45, he is a major and he's sort of going up the ranks. Does he have any inclination to remain in the army? I mean, he was seeking those promotions.
I don't know. Certainly, I have not only letters that he's written, I have letters of the colonel, the Australian colonel that he had reported to. He ends up being the adjutant to this colonel, and they definitely become extremely good friends. And I have a letter from him just telling my dad how much he misses the good times of them all being together. They were all stationed in this place called Taungoo, T-O-U-N-G-O-U. And my father's nickname at that time is Townie of Taungoo. You know, definitely getting well established. There is a lovely letter where they do the farewell for the colonel. They enjoyed what they were doing at that stage, there's no doubt about it. But from what I can see, there wasn't an option to come back. He was a member of the Indian Army still, not the British Army. So he ends up really trying to get a boat home by about January 46. He gets a letter saying this organization will cease to exist from September 46. Well, he's been doing the work for 3 months. And he says, well, so I've been doing all this work for an organization that doesn't exist. And anyway, he puts in to get a boat. And interestingly, as a major in the Indian Army, he got no special concessions. So when he gets the boat eventually, he's put into, it's a one cabin that is normally a six berth cabin, and there's 32 of them in the cabin on the boat home. And he starts his boat home, and that takes a couple of months on the boat. By the time he gets home, end of June, to Liverpool, and that is when he first met my mother, who has been his pen friend for the last 2 years. And next story of the adventure. But I can tell you about what he did do.
Well, I was going to say, what does he do after the war? Because if he's not going in the army.
No, this is a lovely thing. He was offered his old job back as a clerk at Walthamstow Council. He said, no, thank you very much. If you think about it, 46, most of the good jobs had gone. So what he did, he put an advert in the Telegraph saying, ex-army officer, military career, and mechanical expertise, et cetera, et cetera. And he got a letter back. Again, I've got this letter back from a man in Epsom who said, would you like to come and basically run my garage for me? It's a motor showroom, and the good thing is it has a flat above the garage. Now, at that time, there was no jobs going, and more importantly, there was no houses going. And my father said, yeah, I'll come and do that. This is lovely, Angus. This garage is 2 miles away from where I'm sitting now. It's the house in which I was born in the top window of the, and he ran it until he retired. And they expanded it a bit, and my uncle came and helped, and they had two or three garages at one time. But I'm living 2 miles from where he came after the war, which happened to be the coldest winter, and there was no heating and so forth. And the other nice thing is that he'd met my mother, they'd got engaged, and they carried on writing between them. He came down here to work at the garage, and would write his version of the week and then take the thing back and leave it with her. So there's three stories, if you like, that take from the time he got back to the time they got married in May 47. And I tell you, the other lovely coincidence, which I love, is that when I wrote the book and got it published, it was later being published than I expected. And I suppose that's normal. And the publisher said, right, we're going to publish it on the 3rd of May 2022, as in 3rd of May this year. That would have been my mother and father's 75th wedding anniversary.
What a strange coincidence.
Yes. I think it's just lovely. But that was without any prompting with me, and that's the way it happened. So that's what he did. He came back here. He started running the garage. He built it up into a good business. The other side of that, he unfortunately did die before his time. He died in 1984, so when I was only 34, and that is a reason why we never had time really to exchange all these stories before. He was more interested in me and my family growing up and that sort of thing. So that's why it's been a joy.
Folks, if you want to read about Don Townsend, the book is My Road to Mandalay. As ever, I will put a link on the website. Now, if you have enjoyed this episode and would like to support the show, you can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/WW2podcast. It is listeners like you that help me find the time to put the show together. And I do make available extra World War II chat for supporters of the show and advert-free episodes. So that is patreon.com/WW2podcast. In the next episode, I'll be discussing one of the most incredible men to have ever served in the British Army, Adrian Carton de Wyatt. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry, 88mm gun hit our tank, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.